Good morning. It is April 10th, 2020, and I want to speak on the coronavirus, the church, and the civil magistrate, all of which is highly pertinent to any professing Christian today. What I want to do is lay out some things for us to think about with respect to the canceling of church services. I realize this is sort of like a day late and a dollar short. Most churches canceled their services long before any states offered a mandate or gave a mandate that they do so. But I still want us to think about it because we're not out of it yet. We're still under these conditions and circumstances. The time is now. It's on our minds. We're doing a lot of sitting at home, and we have time to think about things, presumably, and to listen to some things. We have more time than ever, perhaps, to do that. This kind of situation that we're facing right now will not probably be the last. And so there's going to be a next time, and I hope that through our failures this time, our struggles, our difficulties, our trials, our questions, our confusion, that we can sort out as Christians how we should be conducting ourselves in times like this and how we should be responding to the civil magistrate. So let me offer first a few clarifications and disclaimers. I do not think COVID-19 is nothing. I don't think it's a hoax. I don't think it's funny. I don't think that it's something to laugh about. I think many people have died. I believe that the death statistics that they're giving us from the Centers for Disease Control are accurate. I don't have any reason to believe they're not. I don't think it's a fun or light thing to go through for those who get seriously ill or those who die from it. I myself have asthma. I've had pneumonia before. I suppose in one sense you could say I'm a risk factor, that I've got comorbidities and so forth. I realize we have no vaccine, no flu shot equivalent, and that this is a new virus hitting everyone, and therefore it's not identical to the flu. I realize that. I recognize that there is a genuine concern on the part of those who are older and those who have weakened immune systems and those who are compromised in some way. I recognize that. I'm not making light of their concerns. I recognize that this is challenging and scary for health workers, doctors and nurses who can be overwhelmed by the number of patients they may be seeing or expecting to see based on the projections. And there are people in the medical field overwhelmed right now. I have no idea whether China deliberately released the virus into the world to create chaos or whether it was gross negligence on their part. I have no idea if big power brokers, one world order types, Illuminati people and so forth, planned such a thing or have decided to make good use of it now that it's out there. I am confident of this, that once it became publicized and known and became an issue, that it's been politicized and that there are many bad actors who have sought to take advantage of it. I fully believe in total depravity, and I'm quite sure there are people doing that all over the place. What I say today has absolutely nothing to do with Donald Trump, with being supportive of him or being against him. I'm overall supportive of Donald Trump, and I plan to vote for him in November. So let's just get that out of the way. Any suspicions somebody might have that this is commentary against Trump to try to, influence people's opinion of him. It's not. What I'm concerned about is that Christians have to think about principles, not who is in the executive branch at the particular time of a particular threat to liberty. And we do have a threat to liberty right now. And we have to be concerned about that as a principle matter. And not get into the issue focused on, well, we don't have to worry about that right now because we have a president who is good with Christian liberty. He's for us. He's on our team. To me, it transcends President Trump. It transcends who's in office at the time. I think, frankly, Christians would be a whole lot more worried about what's going on if Barack Obama was still in office than they are. And that kind of proves my point. All that being said, I do not think that the severe measures of quarantine and stay-at-home orders are justified, and I don't think that church services should be canceled. Now, if you're smart, you don't care whether I think that the quarantine is justified or not. Who am I? I'm nobody in particular. But as a Christian, you should be thinking about, should churches be canceling their services? And so here's five things I think that we should consider. Number one is the death rate. For all the other statistics that we have, the death rate is the bottom line. That tells us how serious this is, not the sensational headlines. I was a journalism major. I wrote headlines. I got training on writing headlines. I worked at a newspaper and wrote headlines. I was a copy editor. I know what it is to write a headline. I know what the thinking is behind writing a headline. You write headlines to get attention. You want to be summarizing what the article is about, hopefully, but you also want to catch the reader's eye and get them to read the article, because more readers means more subscriptions means more advertiser money, and that's what you live off of. Even more so today, when a good deal of the numbers are online articles, and it's all based on hits, and the number of hits that you get boosts your numbers, your traffic, and then advertisers are more interested to advertise there. So a lot of the headlines that you're reading today are written to get you to read the article, and the more sensational, then the better, the more likely they are to get you to read it. Okay, enough about headlines. A 5% death rate, I've been crunching the numbers frequently from the CDC. It was about 1.4% death rate in the United States for those who got the virus, and now it's about 1.5. That does not constitute a high percentage. And this small percentage is likely even much smaller given the fact of testing bias. And testing bias means that only those with symptoms are getting tested. There would be people out there with symptoms who choose not to get tested for whatever reason. And there would be other people who think they had the flu who didn't get tested. And we don't know how long the virus was actually in the country. By the time that we figured out China had lied about it, it could have already been over here sweeping through, and a lot of people thought they had the flu. Now, that would also possibly raise the death statistics, because people that we thought died from the flu might have died from COVID-19, but I seriously doubt that that would compare with the numbers of people that would be tested to have had COVID-19 and yet never any serious complications with it, in which case the death rate would fall even lower. In other words, my point is, we have a numerator, that's the number of deaths. We simply do not know the denominator, that is the number of infections. You can find scholarly, very intelligent, far more intelligent than me, people online talking about this problem of a lack of a denominator. We don't know. Dr. Fauci does not know how many people have been infected already and how many people are currently out there infected. It's the people that are tested that we know. The comparison with the flu here is relevant. Influenza killed approximately 34,000 people last flu season, and it killed 61,000 the year before. And yet no national emergencies were declared, no panic was created, no quarantines and stay-at-home orders were implemented, and we lived on, didn't we? And no church gatherings were banned. So what I'm getting at is, if death, folks, is the great justification for the government's lockdown measures, and that's what seems to be the justification given, right? It's death. That's why we're all sitting at home in our cubicles. Then the government has failed to show how COVID-19 is more deadly than other viruses that cause as many or more deaths. And if you don't take these measures with respect to other diseases, why not? Or perhaps more relevant, why now? And it is not valuing the dollar over lives when we talk about the destruction to the economy. We're talking about lives versus lives. If you destroy the economy, you will destroy lives. There will be all kinds of correlative deaths, people postponing surgeries that they can't get into now because of all the measures, people not able to do therapies, people having deaths of despair, opioid use going up, suicides going up, and so forth. All kinds of things in the third world where things cannot flow as they usually did to help lift them out of their poverty. Now they're going back into it, which means far more deaths. So we're not comparing the stock market with people's lives. We're talking about death versus death, life versus life. The doomsday prophets on the coronavirus and the projections can always win any argument on statistics because they capitalize on what can't be known and therefore what can't be disproven. They use the Imperial College models out of the UK, which were now understood to be grossly abused, which predicted 2 million plus deaths in the US. That was then ratcheted down to 200,000, and now Fauci is saying maybe around 60,000, which is comparable to the flu. And there are two possible lessons from this, you understand. One lesson is the experts have been consistently wrong. They've overblown their models. They used models they shouldn't have. Politicians trusted in that, locked down the economy, ruined it, and now we should be wary of trusting these people again. That's one legitimate lesson from this. Or, of course, it's the opposite. Well, the only reason it turned out so well, that is 60,000 deaths, not 2 million, is because you took our advice of total lockdown, and that was followed. And of course, who can disprove that? You can be wrong, dead wrong, and sound right, and nobody can disprove you. Nobody knows how many would have died if we hadn't done this. There's no numbers you can drum up on that. So the death rate is one reason why I don't think we should lock down the economy, and I don't think we should be shutting down churches. Secondly, the Constitution grants us the right to meet. The First Amendment of the Constitution reads as follows: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Now, it stipulates Congress because in the minds of the founders, of course, Congress was the center branch of government, and it's the one that made laws. And they didn't mean by that, oh, but the Supreme Court and the president can make decrees by fiat restraining people's rights to all of these things. They didn't mean that. So with respect to what is happening today, the First Amendment grants to Americans the right to the free exercise of religion and the right to peaceably assemble. And this was written into the Constitution to keep the governing authorities from abridging such rights. That being the case, the government's actions have been illegal. They are. With respect to church gatherings that violate executive orders of various states, it is not Christians who meet for worship that are participating in illegal activity and civil disobedience. It's the government that's doing so. It is the free exercise of religion, not the exercise of religion in the restrained way the government approves at any given time, based on the arguments they supply at a given time. In the First Amendment, no qualifications are given to the rights granted therein. It doesn't say that we may exercise our religion except when the government deems it too risky. In the current situation, the government can't abrogate our right to assemble while pretending to grant us the right to freely practice our religion so long as we do it in the way approved by the government, namely via cyberspace. Assembling physically is inherent in the free exercise of our religion. That's part of what we have the free exercise to do. The government is here today setting a terrible precedent in taking away First Amendment rights to only slow a virus we'll all be exposed to eventually anyway, or perhaps many of us have already been exposed to. It therefore fails to meet the high threshold it must meet in order to take away these rights, even temporarily. The current action is not comparable to what civil authorities do after a hurricane, imposing curfews after dark to protect businesses. In those cases, they're protecting businesses, but in the current example, they're destroying them, not protecting them. when they impose curfew-like restrictions for an indefinite period of time. The government may have pure motives. They might, sparing hospitals, and yet be using illicit and unlawful means to achieve that objective. We're not a nation, folks, governed by motives. We're a nation supposed to be governed by laws. And if we are a nation of laws, not a nation of office holders who may or may not choose to stay within the boundaries of the law, then the Constitution of the United States is the supreme law of the land, not the office holders who took an oath to it. If citizens are expected to obey the laws, what law are we expected to obey? The Constitution? Or the words of temporary office holders who may set aside the Constitution if they decide to? So think about this. If the Constitution has no greater viability than that which temporary office holders grant to it, then it's nothing. It has no legal authority if it can be quickly set aside by the whim of any Congress, judge, president, or governor. So therefore, when temporary office holders who take an oath to uphold the Constitution, and then they renege on that oath and come into conflict with the Constitution must be obeyed by citizens, even if that incurs punishment at the hands of temporary office holders. It's the Constitution that is our guide, not the temporary office holders. We submit to them who have taken an oath to uphold the Constitution. But if they renege on their oath, who are we now submitting to? Are we just going to wait till another office holder comes in that we hope does follow his oath or her oath? The third reason that I think these restrictions shouldn't be happening and the churches should not be canceling their services is because church history shows us the folly of heeding Caesar on an issue like this. Oppressive governments have long banned religious gatherings they deemed too risky for reasons they thought legitimate and rational. Communist countries have long banned certain gatherings of churches that were not communist-approved churches. Why? Well, they had a compelling and logical reason that seemed sound to them. They had a compelling state interest. It has the potential to destroy national unity. And so in their minds, they had a justifiable reason for forbidding such assemblies. What is the church supposed to do in those countries? Play ball? Submit to the government? Or obey God, not men, and gather for church in an underground way? In the Roman Empire, the first couple hundred years of church history, the Roman government looked suspiciously on Christians in their church gatherings. Christians spoke of eating the body and blood of Jesus, and so they were accused of cannibalism. Christians gathered for what they called love feasts, which were simply the meals they had together with one another on the Lord's Day, with the Lord's Supper annexed, and they referred to that as their love feast. And then they called each other brothers and sisters, and so then they were accused of sexual immorality and incest. But worse of all, the Christians wouldn't play ball with the Roman government rules. The Roman government allowed Christians to have their Jesus God. That's fine, you just keep your Jesus in his properly confined space. But you also need to sacrifice to the Roman gods. That's all we ask. What's so hard about that? We've been very gracious to you. We've let you have your Jesus God. That's fine. Just play ball and be a team player and offer sacrifice to the Roman gods as well. What's the big deal? Well, Christians wouldn't play ball. They wouldn't obey that. And so they were thrown to the lions and the wild beasts and tortured and crucified. Why? Because every bad thing that happened in the empire was perceived to be caused by the Christians' refusal to sacrifice to the gods. So Christians were blamed for every terrible calamity that happened, and the only solution was to get rid of them. You see there that the government in Rome had a compelling state interest in banning Christian worship. At least in their minds it was compelling. It was logical. It was reasonable in their minds. But was it good or evil? It was evil. Should Christians have played ball with the Roman government and submitted to Roman law? No. They didn't, and we admire them. We have books about them. We celebrate and honor their bravery and courage and dedication, and that they counted the cost of discipleship and took up their cross and followed Christ even to death. But the question is, are we like the Pharisees who adorned the tombs of the prophets of old? And we tell ourselves that we're with them. We're with the prophets. Ah, yes, good old Isaiah. Good old Jeremiah. Good old Elijah and Elisha. We're on their side. We like to think that if we were ever faced with a difficult choice like that, we'd do the same. We'd be faithful. We'd give up our lives unto martyrdom. But would we? Don't be deceived. Fast forward almost 2,000 years, not much has changed, has it? In the current coronavirus crisis, Christians are being told they can't assemble each Sunday for worship. Are they going to be cast with the lions? No, and I'm not saying they are. But they're being told not to assemble, or else. And they are magnanimously offered an alternative. The internet. Hey, you've got the internet, just stream your sermon. What more do you want? It should be enough for you. Shut up and play ball. State doesn't care about communion. It doesn't care about sharing meals together. It doesn't care about Christian fellowship. It doesn't care about singing to one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. It doesn't care about the giving of tithes and offerings. It doesn't care about extended opportunities for Bible study and discussion. It doesn't care about the holy kiss and any other modern equivalent of it, physical demonstrations of affection. It doesn't care about prayer meetings. No. Sermon's good enough. Frankly, we don't care about that either. But, yeah, we'll give you that. The state believes that the virus is so bad, forget the actual statistics, that it has a justifiable warrant for taking away the First Amendment right to assemble for worship and the right to the free exercise of religion, not the shackled exercise of religion. So in the state's mind today, talking about state governments here, they are justified, they think, in taking away our rights, and we should just shut up about it. And if we choose to meet for worship anyway, they're ready to blame us for the spread of the virus. Does that sound familiar? Have you noticed the headlines? People blaming churches, blaming Christians for being so obstinate and stubborn and meeting anyway in spite of these orders, in spite of this crisis. It's their fault. Folks, we need to educate ourselves on church history. This is nothing new. This is our test. We've been given a test now. Do you still think you're a kindred spirit with the martyrs? Do you still admire the martyrs, or do you still admire them from afar, from a different century and different challenges? But when it comes to modern-day suffering, you want no part of it. Now, some people will say, look, we need to be a good witness to those around us. And it's not a good witness to meet for church and then start, you know, making everybody think we're responsible for spreading the virus. Everyone's just going to despise you and say you're being selfish and irresponsible and callously spreading the disease. And worse yet, they'll say you're doing it to get attention. Yes, that's right, folks, and it has always been so. Remember what Jesus said in Matthew 5:11? Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Blessed are you when they do that. But according to modern day calculus, well, they would never say that because we'd never let them. The word witness, if you want to talk about being a good witness, is an interesting one. Do you know what the Greek word for witness is? Martyrion. Martyr. That's how Christians really witness the best, by being martyrs, or at least by being crucified daily. They show in their witness that Christ is more important than anything else. They love the approval of God rather than the approval of men, John 12. They take up their cross and follow Christ. It's not a gold necklace around their neck, it's an instrument of their own execution. Even if it means in being insulted and lied about and misunderstood. Martyrs are rarely admired in their day. They are despised in their day. They are fondly remembered much later. I remember going to a conference one time and listening to Joseph Son, who spent years in Romanian communist prisons. And he had a moment of crisis on the sort of suffering that he was going through. And he said, you know, I was deceived. I imagined that my sufferings would go like this. They would come and arrest me, and they would walk me through the streets. And on each side of the streets would be a gauntlet of Christians clapping and saying, yay, Joseph! Go, Joseph! Instead, the Christians pick up mud and threw it at me. It's stolen martyrdom. You don't get to be celebrated as loyal, as zealous for God. You're treated as a scumbag, a troublemaker, an embarrassment. Reason number four, the draconian measures are unjust. While presuming to be just, by presuming to fulfill, love your neighbor. Is it loving my neighbor to be on lockdown? Which neighbor? The one who might not get COVID-19 from me because I might be a carrier? Or the neighbor who is out of a job because of all the lockdowns? Who are we loving? All the disemployed people? All the problems that that's creating throughout society? Is that loving your neighbor? Or are we just cherry-picking when we talk about love your neighbor? You know, alleviating the potential on hospitals, the burden on them, is considerate to hospital workers. And that's commendable, and I'm sympathetic to that. I have good friends whom I love who work in hospitals. I have family members who work in hospitals, and some who shortly will, God willing. But we can't only consider hospitals. There are thousands of other businesses and professions in our country to also consider when making public universal policies that affect everyone. We can't simply spare hospitals in a way that shifts the burden to millions of others. Otherwise, we're really not alleviating pain, we're just moving it around. Or we're causing one kind of pain to avoid another kind of pain. And then, in that case, the government is unjustly picking winners and losers, something they have a habit of doing. Whereas the draconian measures imposed by the government might help the small percentage of those who become critically ill with the virus, great harm is most certainly done to the vast majority of people who won't become critically ill. Is that just? Many people are finding that their health needs, their therapy, their pain-related problems, you know, they can't go to workout facilities, they can't go to swim, they can't do various things, surgeries that they had hoped to have are now being delayed and put off. Those are all set aside indefinitely so that we can delay the exposure we'll have to COVID-19, so that a very small percentage of people who get critically ill won't get ill yet. Is this just? Is it just to declare as non-essential millions of employees of various businesses? How do you determine what is essential? Isn't the income people get from their work essential to them and their families? Is it just to solve that problem by trillion-dollar stimulus packages that will be loaded on present and future generations? Is that just? It's really easy for well-paid government officials to tell millions of others to stay home and not work. Easy for them to do. They're still getting paid. They didn't lose their job. Is it just for the government to lock down society to prevent several thousand deaths while it shows no inclination whatsoever to declare a national emergency over abortion? Millions die each year from abortion. Far, far more. Dwarfing the numbers that will die from COVID-19. And yet the government doesn't shut down the economy, disemploy millions of people, and abrogate our civil liberties until the crisis of abortion is resolved. Fifth reason. Christ is the head of the church, not Caesar. Who is the head of the church? Christ or Caesar? Obviously it's Christ. What does that mean? What is to be done then when Christ tells the church to do one thing and Caesar says do the opposite? Who's your head? The head is the one you obey. That's who you're a slave of, is the one you obey. Christ says to gather for church. Caesar says no. Just do it online. indefinitely. Whom do you obey? Who is your head? Christ is the head of the church. He has authority over the church. Ephesians 1:20-23. Which he brought about in Christ when he raised him from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places, far above all rule and authority and power and dominion. Far above all of those authorities. And every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in the one to come. And he put all things in subjection under his feet. That all things that are in subjection under his feet includes the civil magistrate, folks, who is far below Christ. And he gave him, Christ, as head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all. So when Caesar commands Christians to do something, Christians should obey, Romans 13. Except when the authorities command us to do something God has forbidden us to do, or to omit something God has commanded us to perform. In such cases, we must join with the apostles and reply, whether it is right in the sight of God to give heed to you rather than to God, you be the judge. For we cannot stop speaking about what we have seen and heard. And yet, it is not only illicit for government authorities to censor Christian doctrine, but also to forbid their assemblies. We have a right to preach what God tells us to preach, and we have a right and a duty, frankly, to meet when God tells us to meet. It is a God-given right, and in America, we have an unusual privilege to have it as a constitutional right. But I'm afraid we're not worthy of it. You know, the Jewish authorities, when the disciples said that, when the apostles said, is it right in the sight of God to give heed to you rather than to God? Those government officials, those civil magistrates, they had a compelling state interest in banning the apostles from preaching about the resurrection. They probably could have offered, hey, if you guys want to go out and sort of have informal Bible studies and preach on Deuteronomy, that'd be fine. Just don't talk about Jesus. Don't talk about him being raised from the dead. That's what you cannot do. What if the apostles had said, oh, okay, I see you're being very magnanimous. I see, that's very generous of you. Thank you. Tell you what, I see you've been very compromised. We'll meet you halfway and we'll do that. Yeah. No. Is meeting for church essential? I don't know who decides, Caesar or Christ. Who's the head of the church? Thus saith the Lord, Exodus 28-11, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you, or your son, or your daughter, your male or your female servant, or your cattle, or your sojourner, who stays with you. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. This is a creation ordinance. God established it from the beginning. Just like he established marriage from the beginning. Marriage isn't abrogated, neither is the Sabbath. Aspects of the Sabbath are, of course, abrogated from the Old Testament and a nation state and a theocracy and so forth in transferring over to a new covenant situation. But the Sabbath principle is not abrogated. It is continued on in the Lord's day. Isaiah 58:13-14 says, if because of the Sabbath you turn your foot from doing your own pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy day of the Lord honorable, and honor it, desisting from your own ways, from seeking your own pleasure, and speaking your own word, then you will take delight in the Lord, and I will make you ride on the heights of the earth, and I will feed you with the heritage of Jacob your father, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. Acts 2:42-47 describes what the early church was doing. They were continually devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone kept feeling a sense of awe, and many wonders and signs were taking place of the apostles. And all those who had believed were together and had all things in common, and they began selling their property and possessions and were sharing them with all, as anyone might have need. day by day, continuing with one mind in the temple, and breaking bread from house to house, they were taking their meals together with gladness and sincerity of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people, and the Lord was adding to their number day by day those who were being saved. What a picture. Acts 27 says, on the first day of the week, that's the Lord's day, when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul began talking to them, intending to leave the next day, and he prolonged his message until midnight. That was a long sermon. The guy fell out of the window and died from it. Fortunately, Paul had the gift of miracles and raised him back up. But they were gathered together to break bread on the first day of the week, and they heard a message from Paul. Sound like church? Hebrews 10:24-25, and let us consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds, not forsaking our own assembling together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. Now, I'm not saying that people who have stayed home during the coronavirus are in the habit of staying away from church, but we're going to develop the habit of it. Could it be that this stimulating one another to love and good deeds requires you to assemble together, that you really can't do the one without the other? So you see, this is what the Bible says, and therefore we look to the head of the church, Christ, not to some other general of some other army. We look to the general of our army. That's the one who commands us. And we see, what does he want us to do? What does he say? What are his marching orders? So it's irrelevant if the government deems weekly gatherings as non-essential. It's none of their business. They're not our boss when it comes to the church. When it comes to matters of the church, they are not our boss. Christ has given the civil magistrate a certain level of authority to boss us around in all kinds of other ways, including taxes, high taxes. Perhaps. Christ doesn't interfere with that. They can tell us where to stop at the street and when we can stop and go and how much of a fine it is to do this and whether you can throw your trash out on the sidewalk or not, and if you do, what consequences there will be, and penalties for stealing and theft and private property and all kinds of matters given to them. Wide latitude of areas of life that the civil magistrate has, but it does not have Christian worship in its domain. That is Christ's domain. Church is much more than listening to a sermon. And it's not for the Caesar to decide what is sufficient for Christian worship and make decrees about what God should accept. And it is for these reasons that the church ought to continue gathering together for church in spite of the recommendations or mandates from Caesar. I say this message with a bit of fear and trembling. I don't expect to make any friends by it. I expect perhaps that some pastors will jump all over me, that my worst enemies will come from within the camp of people who have done things differently and need to justify that decision, and be very angry at me for stirring it up. But I feel this is necessary to say this, and I hope that we learn through this experience, this trial, this bottom whipping that we're getting, this judgment of God, a discipline from the rod of God. And I don't know, folks, we may have to bend over and grab our ankles. We may be in this for a while. I hope not, but we'll have to endure the beating as long as it takes. And I hope we'll learn and grow from it and through it so that we will be better prepared for the next crisis. Amen.